Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we hear about a UN resolution to help combat ISIS. We speak with the AJC Berlin director about how Europe is responding to terrorism. Does warming U.S.-Cuban relations mean a new field for America's game?
People have jumped to the conclusion that now everybody's going to be heading to Havana for tourism and the embargo is going to be dropped. Cubans will be flooding the major leagues.
And we take a look at that long-awaited new Star Wars film. It's right here on The Voice of America. A UN resolution is designed to stem the flow of cash to the Islamic State terrorist organization. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir joins us on the line from the headquarters in New York. Welcome, Margaret.
Hey, Susan. Thank you.
No, thank you. What does this resolution say?
Well, it is a really long resolution. It's about 30 pages, and that's exceptional for a UN Security Council resolution. They're usually somewhere between like 2 and 8 pages. So this one is really very technical, very precise in its language. It's focused on cutting off the flow of money to Islamic State coffers, and so it's very technical in sort of the ways that that will be done through the international banking system.
So if I read it, I probably wouldn't understand it, is what you're saying.
Well, I don't think I understood half of it.
It's legal talk, legal talk.
Legal financial talk.
Yeah. Well, how binding is it on member nations?
Well, all Security Council resolutions are legally binding, so this will become a new piece of international law, basically. So states have an obligation under the provisions in the resolution to report back to what's called a sanctions committee, and that committee monitors compliance with the resolution's provisions, and countries will have to tell the UN what they're doing to stop money getting to terrorists, specifically ISIL. So let me just give you an example. In Iraq, they're trying to close banks in areas of the country under Islamic State control. So perhaps Iraq would write to the UN and say, we have closed a bank in Anbar province. We have done this measure to keep money being transferred there or to keep the terrorists from transferring money from Anbar to other places where they might have, like, let's say, Raqqa in Syria, where they might do some sort of terrorist operation.
Well, what else has the UN done in the fight against ISIS?
Well, there's been a lot in the Security Council. About a year ago, President Obama chaired a meeting of the Security Council on the sidelines of the 2014 UN General Assembly, and that was on stemming the flow of foreign terrorist fighters into the group, because I think, as we all know, many of the foot soldiers for Islamic State are coming from Europe and from Africa and some from the United States. So this has been a big problem, so it was meant to put to help countries share information. I mean, that's one of the big ways they're trying to combat this problem. Let's share information. Let's coordinate efforts. Interpol and other agencies, let's all share because we need to stop people from getting into our countries and from leaving our countries and from leaving our countries, going to Syria or Iraq, committing heinous crimes, and then coming back to our countries. So there's been, under that resolution, I think, more cooperation and coordination. And last May, there was a meeting of interior ministers where they talked about similar measures. And so today's meeting is the first time, really, that finance ministers have come to the Security Council, because usually it's ambassadors, foreign ministers, but today it's finance ministers, and that's meant to be sort of symbolic in that, we're focusing on the cash to ISIS, so we got to stop it, and these are the guys who have the technical know-how to do it.
Well, thank you very much, Margaret, for your insight.
You're welcome, Susan. Thank you.
On social media concerning the ISIS problem, Hillary Clinton writes, "We can't afford another major ground war in the Middle East. That's exactly what ISIS wants." And Fox News says, "The front line with ISIS isn't just in Iraq and Syria. It's also in Kennedy Airport and the Rio Grande." Also trending today is tensions in Baltimore after a mistrial was declared in the Freddie Gray case. Fox News quotes the Freddie Gray family attorney Billy Murphy as saying, "I don't think either side won or lost. There are plenty of articles and photos about the trial at hashtag Freddie Gray." Also a hot topic, the new Star Wars movie. And we'll have more on that later in our program. And on the Golden State Warriors, NBA.com says, the 2015 NBA champion Golden State Warriors garnered more than 1 billion social impressions during the month of November, as the team was in the process of establishing a new NBA record for the most consecutive wins to begin a season. It was the first time that the club surpassed 1 billion impressions in a calendar month during the NBA's regular season. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Have you ever watched a dog or cat drink water and wonder how they are able to quench their thirst from what appears to be some rather sloppy and haphazard actions? Well, it turns out that the parched poochies and kitties know exactly what they're doing. And according to a new study, they're actually executing some rather precise and high-speed movements that allow them to get needed fluids. Dogs and cats each have their own unique drinking methods. As dogs lap up the water, they're actually moving their tongues very quickly to overcome the water's inertia and force it up into their mouths. Cats use a much smoother action and merely skim the surface of the water. Cats and dogs have had to develop these unique methods since neither of them are able to create suction to help them drink, like humans and other animals such as elephants and horses. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Following the terrorist attacks in Paris, Europe is on high alert for more violence. Deidre Berger is the Berlin director of the American Jewish Committee and is now visiting the United States. She joins us on the line from Philadelphia. Welcome, Deidre.
Thank you. Glad to be here in Philly.
How do you perceive how Europe is responding to this threat of terrorism?
Europe is confused. Europe is divided. There's not a cohesive response at the moment to the terrorism threat. There are different situations in different countries, but above all, there needs to be better coordination. The European Union has just appointed a central coordinator for sharing of intelligence, Gerhard Conrad, who's negotiated numerous spy exchanges, including between Israel and Palestine, but there has not as yet been the degree of cooperation that I think many in Europe would like to see, and that's important. There was a breakthrough recently where there was an agreement to share in more detail passenger records, and this has been somewhat disputed for some time, but the threat, the very current threat and the impressions of the horrible shootings and killings November 13th in Paris, I think, are bringing Europe together and accelerating the fight against terrorism.
Are the Muslims facing severe discrimination as a result of these terrorist acts?
There is, of course, resentment, anxieties about Muslims in general due to these terrorist acts. It happens anywhere in the world. I don't think this is special to Europe, but it's a problem for some. But I think there also, on the other hand, needs to be more recognition within Muslim communities of the importance of speaking out and distancing themselves from acts of terrorism. The Muslim community is not well organized in Europe, by and large. These are individual groups of people. They may go to individual mosques, but there are not very strong umbrella organizations with spokespeople who can speak out on these issues. I think that this has caused additional problems because there aren't partners in the community for governments to the degree they would like to have them within the Muslim community. There is, of course, discrimination in Europe on many levels. Religion is one factor. People are also discriminated against because of socioeconomic status, because of skin color. There's racism. There are many issues. But I think important to know is with this wave of terrorism, many of the young attackers in Paris came from relatively stable backgrounds, even middle class. This is not just a problem of poor, deprived people rising up and turning to terrorism. It's a much more complex problem, the sympathies with extremist movements at the moment.
What about the threat posed by accepting refugees from Syria that may actually be members of ISIS? It's very controversial here in the States, where we recently had a terror attack involving a migrant from Pakistan.
There is a certain risk, there's no doubt about it, particularly because in Europe, there's really not the opportunity at the moment to extensively screen the backgrounds of those who are pouring in. There's simply too many refugees. In Germany alone, 965,000 refugees have come through the end of November. Hundreds of thousands have yet to even be documented because the offices are running around the clock, and they still can't process all the applications at the moment. So, of course, there's a danger that ISIS and other terrorist groups are using the gaps in the system at the moment. However, it's almost not necessary. The larger issue is homegrown terrorism, as we saw from the attacks in Paris and other attacks that we've had in Brussels and Toulouse. These were not disaffected Syrian refugees. These were young people, French, Belgians, who grew up in the heart of Europe and have turned to terrorism. This is the much larger threat. Of course, there's concern about the incoming refugees, that they will be prey and to the Salafists, to the extremist movements. But let's remember, most of these refugees are fleeing extremism. Many of them are persecuted minorities. They're Kurds, they're Yazidis, they're Christians. I think that the real danger is in Europe waking up to the fact that there's terrorism in its midst, as we just saw in the United States with San Bernardino. This is a much larger global fight against terrorism and extremism, and it needs much greater resources than we've allocated to it presently.
Well, thank you very much, Deirdre, and I hope you enjoy your trip to the United States.
Thank you so much.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Coming up on International Edition, take me out to the ball game, Cuban style. And may the force be with you. Delegations from the United States and Cuba have been meeting this week in Washington to discuss restoring commercial aviation links severed after the Communist Revolution in the 1960s. Despite the continued U.S. trade embargo, it would represent another economic link since the two governments announced their intention to reestablish diplomatic relations 1 year ago. However, actual flights are still believed to be months off. Also, still a long way off is any kind of agreement to have a North American Major League Baseball franchise in Cuba. But a small step has been taken with an MLB goodwill mission to Cuba this week. Former player and manager Joe Torre, the league's chief baseball officer, says baseball officials want to find a safe and legal way for Cuban athletes who want to play in the professional league to do so without having to defect.
I don't think any negotiations are going to go on here. I think there's an ongoing conversation that's going on. You know, before we got here, Dan Halem is attorney for MLB, and it's just a matter, and you heard him talk today, it's a matter of just making sure the logistics and everything that's going to satisfy both governments. That's what it comes down to. And I don't think anything's going to be concluded here. You know, I'm not saying there's not going to be conversation, but there's no official negotiation going on.
Torre was accompanied to Havana by two of between 20 and 25 Cubans, mostly defectors, who play each season in Major League Baseball. Freelance sports writer and Cuban baseball historian Peter Bjorkman says the fact that Cuba allowed the defectors to return is significant, but says caution about the future is warranted.
There's been so much made in the last year about the opening of relations, and people have jumped to the conclusion that now everybody's going to be heading to Havana for tourism, and the embargo is going to be dropped. Cubans will be flooding the major leagues. And of course, that hasn't come about. And I think it's going to be a very slow process here.
We asked if the MLB is considering having exhibition games in Cuba or even having a franchise there.
Well, there's been talk about those things. Of course, I think one of the other things that MLB would certainly like to have would be the possibility of going into Cuba and setting up academies like they have in the Dominican Republic and Venezuela, where they sign up the young teenage players and train them for possible professional play in the United States. But I think the thing that has to be kept in mind here is that, you know, we tend to think here in the United States all the time that the U.S. calls the shots, or in terms of baseball and MLB will make these decisions. And really, the Cubans are going to have the final say in all of this, and they're not going to be too willing to give up the baseball system that they have and simply let MLB come in and kind of clean the island out of all the talent. I don't think that's going to happen. So I think we're going to see a very slow development here, and it's going to be interesting how this all plays out.
And how does Cuban baseball differ from what we have here in the United States?
Cuba has a great baseball tradition, and they have some tremendous talent, probably outside of the U.S. and maybe Japan. They have the richest talent font, you know, anywhere in the world. The players have always stayed at home in Cuba, although there's been a slow leaking now in recent years of some of their top players. But for the Cuban ball players, the biggest thing always was play on the national team and be a national hero back in their home country. This has changed somewhat now with the sagging economy in Cuba and with the big dollars that some of the defectors have gotten. And it's really what's happened now in Cuba is that for the young aspiring players to be a big star on their own home island, they have to be one of those guys up in the major leagues earning $30 or $40 million and not so much a star in the national team at home now, because the national team doesn't win all the tournaments anymore. They've had such a significant talent drain.
When will we see Major League Baseball playing in Cuba?
There was a group down there a couple of weeks ago exploring the possibilities of maybe putting a minor league franchise in Havana. There was even talk of a AAA franchise. There have been talk of spring training games in Havana. What people don't understand is the status of the infrastructure in Cuba. Right now, I don't think Major League Players Association would allow players to play on the field in Havana in a spring training exhibition game. So there's that issue. But also, as far as having a franchise down there, if you can't put a minor league franchise today in a city like, let's say, Memphis or Charlotte or someplace like that, I mean, how are you going to put one in Havana where you're talking about a third world country? Even high-level minor league baseball now depends on corporate box seats, television rights. The Cuban infrastructure, the Cuban economy right now just doesn't allow that, and it's going to take several years to rebuild that structure, even if there's a great inpouring of capital from the U.S.
Peter Bjorkman says among the stumbling blocks to improved baseball relations is Cuba's insistence that its players in the major leagues be allowed to play on the island during the off-season. U.S. teams with players under contract would be reluctant to allow that because of the risk of injury. Then there is the embargo, which prevents money earned in the U.S. to go to Cuba. While he can foresee MLB exhibition games in Cuba in a couple of years, sustaining a minor league team there will take longer. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called SwiftKey Symbols. It's an Android app with a picture-based keyboard that makes it easier for kids with autism to express themselves. The app lets users construct sentences by picking an image from several categories, such as people, actions, and colors, then predicts and suggests other words to continue the sentence.
Want Friday, tomorrow, Saturday, toy car.
So you want to play with your toy car.
This new technology is being used at Riverside School in London, where nearly two-thirds of the 220 pupils have autism. Charlotte Parkhouse is the school's language therapist.
To see our pupils use this app and suddenly they discover the joy of interaction between themselves, between themselves and adults, is really wonderful.
The SwiftKey company in London has not announced the launch date for this app, which they say is still in the very early stages of testing. VOA's What's New. I'm Todd Grossons.
The latest installment in the Star Wars saga, Star Wars The Force Awakens, has opened in Los Angeles. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the long-awaited film is living up to the anticipation and offers fans a new story for a new generation.
A who's who of Hollywood turned out for the premiere in Los Angeles Monday night. Star Wars The Force Awakens takes up the story 30 years after the end of The Return of the Jedi. The galaxy is still at war between the forces of the First Order, an offshoot of the old Galactic Empire, and the Resistance, the next generation of the old Rebel Alliance. The film features many of the heroes from the saga, including Han Solo, Leia Organa, Chewbacca, R2-D2, and C-3PO. Anthony Daniels, who plays the protocol droid C-3PO, said Monday that director J.J. Abrams has produced a film that a new generation of fans will fall in love with.
Because the care and attention, the love, the detail, everything, the enthusiasm, the excitement that JJ and the whole team brought to it, and the cast, it's being echoed tonight.
Harrison Ford reprises his role as smuggler and rebel fighter Han Solo. He said it was great to be back in the old role.
You know, people have been anticipating this film for a long time, and that's a good thing. And we had a really good script, and JJ is a director that I really admire, have for a long, long time. I was pleased to be back.
Adam Driver plays the new villain in the series, Kylo Ren, who has sworn to take revenge on the rebels for destroying the Empire. Driver says the magnitude of his role didn't hit him until he got on set.
It really didn't hit me, actually, until I walked into this guy's office, who's Michael Kaplan, who did the costumes for it, and I saw everybody's drawing on the wall, and that was the first time that it really hit me. And it's a Star Wars movie.
John Boyega plays Finn, a stormtrooper who finds his loyalties divided between the First Order and the Resistance. Boyega says that being part of the iconic series is mind-boggling.
Yeah, I feel great. I feel fantastic, and I feel surprisingly relaxed. I mean, this is an environment that I feel like is loving enough. I'm a Star Wars fan, so I feel like we're paying homage to a film that I really respect, so I feel good.
Star Wars The Force Awakens also stars Oscar winner Lupita Nyong'o. Daisy Ridley plays Rai, a scavenger who gets drawn into the conflict. Mark Hamill reprises his role of Luke Skywalker, the Jedi Master, and Carrie Fisher returns as Leia. Game of Thrones star Gwendolyn Christie stars as Captain Phasma, the first female stormtrooper.
I just feel like Lucasfilm and Disney have listened to what people want, and in being more diverse with the casting choices and creating characters like Captain Phasma, I think they've really listened to what it is people want to see on their screens.
Star Wars The Force Awakens opens in wide release in the United States Friday. It is the first of four new Star Wars movies due out by 2019. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. And if you'd like to hear this program again, visit our website, voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for listening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Even as the world marks the 67th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, China continues to crack down on rights defenders and others who seek to peacefully question official policy and contribute to the public discourse on China's future. Since July, the Chinese government has detained nearly 300 lawyers and activists. The United States has called for the release of more than 20 such people who remain in custody, as well as Ilham Tati, Kenpo Kartsi, Zhong Kai, Gao Yu, and Liu Xiaobo. Rights lawyer Pu Jichang, who was arrested following his participation in a private meeting to peacefully mark the 25th anniversary of the violent suppression of the Tiananmen Square protests, is currently on trial. He stands accused of making criminal comments online, inciting ethnic hatred, and picking quarrels and provoking troubles. Pu Jichang has been detained since May 2014. The United States mission to the United Nations recently expressed concern with China's national security law, noting that it codifies an expansive and vague definition of national security that invites arbitrary and situational interpretation by security forces. In addition, the United States is also concerned that the government's draft foreign non-governmental management law would unreasonably constrict civil society and undermine people-to-people exchange. It is incumbent on China to uphold the rights enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Marking the 67th anniversary of this important document on December 10th, President Barack Obama said, "We will continue to lift up the lives of all who yearn to exercise their inherent human rights and to shine a light on those still living in the darkest pockets of our world."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.